on FM, online, and on TuneIn 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
And you're listening to The Space Show. Recently, the people in Sydney University were very, very excited, and they got a satellite into space. It's called Kuava 1. It's a CubeSat, which is a very small satellite. And Ivor Cairns from Sydney University is going to explain what it's all about.
I'd like to tell you, as Wayne said, a little bit about Kuava, which is the ARC training center for CubeSats, UAVs, and their applications, and about some of our first CubeSat, the Kuava 1 CubeSat, very imaginatively named. So let me tell you a little bit about Kuava itself. And overall, we have about 11 chief investigators named investigators at universities, and 12 partner investigators from various companies and government labs. And our focus is trying to develop or help develop a world-class Australian space industry in CubeSats, UAVs, and their products. So it's not just the science or engineering that the boys and girls at Kuava can get interested in. It's also the products and services that we hope to develop for the greater good. So let me just, I've used the word CubeSat quite a few times. So what does it mean? It really does mean that you build your satellite out of cubes, which are approximately 10 centimeters on a side. And if you want, so this would be a one unit or one U CubeSat. And if you want to make a bigger one, you make it in, for instance, two cubes, put one on top of the other, or a 3U CubeSat. Kuava 1, which we'll talk about, is a 3U CubeSat. Inspire 2, which we put into space as a collaboration between Sydney Uni, UNSW, and ANU, was a 2-unit CubeSat. Less than about 1.3 kilograms per unit, above 200 kilometers to be in space proper. And you get real power from having a well-defined standard. It's just like with the mobile phones, where the great rise of them came about because everyone said we're going to have a certain number of standards for the voltages, for the characteristic size, for the communication protocols on the electronics boards, standardize things, and then people could innovate within boundaries and create something better that was easily sellable. And that's the same sort of idea with CubeSats, where you standardize the size, the characteristics, and then focus, hopefully, on the payloads. So we'll talk a little bit more about Kuava. We put in a proposal to the Australian Research Council. It was awarded in mid-2017. The amount of money is about $4.5 million from the ARC and $1.2 million from the partners over 5 years. So, you know, a bit over $1 million a year on average, and which all of us look at and we say, oh, that's a lot of money. And it is, but it doesn't go very far when you have something like, 12, 14 students, five postdoctoral fellows, an engineer, an operations and research admin manager, and you want to put things into space or onto UAVs. That money, unfortunately, goes fairly quickly. We expect to do 2 to 3 CubeSats over our 5-year lifetime, and we're now in our fourth year, and so we've got just approximately a half years to go nominally. So let me tell you a little bit about Kuava 1. It's a 3-unit CubeSat, so you know what that means. But let's start at the base here. So you see the 3-unit frame. Quite literally, it's a frame which you then put boards or PCBs or components inside. But you also have things on the outside. Those include the solar cells. And it's interesting to note that two of those solar cells come from an Australian provider, AeroWave Communications, one of our partners, and the rest come from overseas. So actually, we're going to be demonstrating some Australian tech in space from the point of view of spacecraft components. Got a number of antennas and apertures, GPS antennas, this little grey guy here, the square, and then the apertures, those are for the imaging instrument ISTE, which I'll talk about in a moment. Magnetometer, various sun and earth pointing things for our attitude determination and control system, or ADCS, which is part of this big block here. We've got a electrical power supply, or EPS, here, onboard computer, the radio, the antennas, which deploy. So those are basically the spacecraft components. And then this didn't translate very well here, but we have a GPS receiver here from UNSW. And then the bigger one here called ISTE. ISTE is obviously a mouthful. The I is for imaging. The S is for spectrometer. Sorry, the I is for imager. The S is for spectrometer. The T is for Toloman, or rather Toloboy. And then the final I is instrument. So it's three instruments in one, which I'll talk a very little bit more about. And then we have the RUSH payload, which, as we'll see in a moment, is focused on reconfigurable electronics, so FPGAs associated with energetic particles coming from the sun in space weather events, coming into the spacecraft, causing a single event upset or a bit flip, leading to problems in the electronics. The system recognizes that and then reconfigures to be able to remove that error in the memory or the computer code. So it's quite an important payload. And then we have a little radiation counter and a power data bus. And the thing that's interesting there is that many of us use data over power lines or connectors. And we're doing exactly the same in space for our instrument, which at one level is a rather simple innovation, but it's also one of the first times that this has been done. Okay, so one thing you'll notice here is perhaps that this area here looks rather bare or empty. It is. That's because we were going to have a high-speed communications payload from one of our partners, and that partner, unfortunately, was not able to deliver. And so we had to chop it out of the manifest approximately 1 year ago. And actually, that's when the RUSH payload came on. But at times, I was trying to get other instruments to get on and ideally to pay us something for that privilege. But for Coaba 1, that rideshare opportunity has gone. We've now built the spacecraft. And it's future ones that will be interested in giving rides to other groups for money in general. So let me come to that a bit later. It is a jigsaw puzzle, putting together these different instruments and PCBs together, connecting them, making sure that the sizing is right, that they don't push the frame out too much or cause the frame to go in too much, both of which are problems. But everything works, and we're happy with it. So now one of the issues about building a satellite like this is actually getting it to be the right size. And the tolerance is incredibly small. It's 100 microns. It's the width of a human hair. And personally, I find this extremely frustrating. I'm more a theorist. And so this sort of detail I didn't like at all. But it turns out to be really important because one has to fit the spacecraft into the deployer. And the idea is that you put it in and there's a spring at the far end. And when a astronaut or the ground station commands it, this little door will open. The spring at the other end will go ping and the spacecraft will come happily moving out. And so you have to be able to move your CubeSat in and out of that smoothly. About 8 months ago, we thought we were ready to deliver. We believed the spacecraft fitted because we had put the spacecraft into the fit check case and it seemed to be fine, but we had to use a bit of force to put it in. And we were told that that was all right. And then JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency, which looked at it and said, we see scratches on your spacecraft. We think you're not the right size. And we then had to go back and retest it. You know, tolerance inaccuracies, both on our spacecraft and in the deployer and in the fit check case are problematic. And when we first got told that we weren't the right size, I didn't believe it, or at least I said, that may be true, but what's the chance of your fit check case being the wrong size? Because we'd been told that previously, when Shirley-Ann did a satellite, that it was the wrong size. So we ended up having to do this very extensive set of measurements to work out what was the case. And we found out that actually we were over. In some places, our surfaces were not perfectly parallel, but only by about 200 microns, so at most size of two human hairs. And that was enough to make a big difference. So accuracy really is important here.
88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
In May of this year, Professor Ivor Cairns from Sydney University and the Kuava organisation spoke to the Space Industry Association of Australia. And the space show was there and recorded the goings-on. And in this section, he describes in more detail the Kuava 1 satellite.
So deorbiting at end of life. So we're going to go to the space station and be deployed from there. So we'll start at, you know, somewhere between 390 and 425 kilometres, depending on where the space station is when we get launched or deployed. And we'll drift down with time. It's just friction or collisions with air molecules and plasma particles that will slow down the spacecraft and heat it up. And as it slows, it will fall towards the Earth more, its orbit will become lower, and eventually it will get sufficient friction that it will heat up and start melting and eventually burning. So the spacecraft will die before it hits the ground. We predict, according to the calculations we've done, that it will be entirely burnt up and melted before it gets to 120 kilometers altitude. And that would take it somewhere between about a year and a year and a half. It's difficult to be more precise because solar activity can give rise to heating of the atmosphere, and that puffs it up. And so you get more friction at a higher altitude, which brings you in faster. So if there's a lot of solar activity, we expect to deorbit quicker, and we are moving from solar minimum now into the rising phase of the solar cycle. So we're moving towards solar max. So that's one aspect. On the other hand, we have an ADCS, so we hope to mostly orbit like this as we're moving along, and that will reduce the cross-section, reduce the drag. But there will be times when we want to be like this so as to observe particular things. So we don't have to do anything active there, but probably if we wanted to make it deorbit quickly, we'd let the spacecraft tumble, and that would increase the cross-section in general and get us to deorbit. The power generated, that varies obviously with whether you're in the sunlight and whether you're rotating or not, tumbling. We predict something like 1.7 watts averaged over the orbit. So we need to make sure that time averaged, our power usages are less than 1.7 watts. That means many of our instruments have to be turned on and off. Okay, next question from John Lee. In CubeSats, are measures taken against radio frequency interference or electromagnetic pulse protection? So the answer is no efforts are taken against electromagnetic pulse protection. Basically, if an EMP goes off in orbit, we and most spacecraft are going to be dead. And many of us on Earth are probably going to be dead because one source of EMPs is nuclear devices. But radio frequency interference, yes, we have to make sure that we do not cause interference with stations on Earth. And so that means that we have to be, the ACMA requires us to be able to stop transmitting if we're interfering with others. So we have to work on that. But we're in the amateur, all of our frequencies are in the amateur band. We are going to work substantially with the amateur community, whether that's them detecting our radio beacons and putting them onto a website so we can get the data, or whether it's maybe over time us expanding the domain of the orbit in which we try and downlink data. Because at the moment, we're only going to downlink with and be controlled by the Mission Control Center / Responsive Space Operations Center down in Adelaide, which the agency has just opened and which our partner Sabre Astronautics is running. So we're expecting to work, well, Sabre will be working with us on that, and it's a great system that they've produced. Some of that with a little bit of help from us, but mostly internal Sabre work. Okay, with all the thousands of satellites being launched now and in the future, have you taken into account the possibility of collisions? So yes, the answer is yes. That is, for better or worse, part of the analysis we've had to do recently for the space agency. You know, we're launching only from 400 kilometers. Everything's going to burn up. But, you know, there still is the possibility of the spacecraft disintegrating a little bit further up than the sort of 200 kilometers height that we expect if it's hit by something. And we've calculated the possibility of collisions. And from memory, the probability of a collision is about 1 in 10 to the 5. So about 1 in 100,000. As far as I'm aware, there's been no reported, believed case of a CubeSat being hit with debris and being able to report it. But it's also true that the number of spacecraft collisions with debris, you know, the number of reported cases is small. Doesn't mean they're not happening. It means probably that most commercial groups just do not report such data because they don't want their customers to, you know, believe that their capability is at risk. So they don't want to report bad news, but, you know, potentially bad news or bad things. But we have done it.
From Paran to Parkdale, you're listening to Southern FM.
And this is The Space Show.